song we sang said, "Blessed Jesus, thou hast promised to receive us, sinful though we are." I don't think that's the exact words, but isn't that exciting that Jesus has promised to receive us even though we're sinful? Unless you think you're righteous, then you got a problem. But you know who you are. I know who I am, but he still promised to receive us. As I walked in after Sunday school, I saw Les's picture up teaching a class, and it reminded me of a conversation I had with him just recently with him, and whenever I talk to him, Tanya's always in the background, and we end up talking to all three of us talking. And I found something out. I found out that most Sundays, they listen, they log on to the internet, and they listen to what went on here on Sunday mornings, basically the sermon. So that gave me an idea when I walked in and saw their pictures. I want to give you all a chance to talk to them this morning. So on the count of three, I'll give you the opportunity to say hey to Les and Tanya. Okay? One, two, three. Hey Les and Tanya. I don't know if does Tommy and Jeanette listen to it? Do you know at all? Not Tommy and Jeanette. I know they don't. They're always sleeping. Sorry about that, Tommy. Tommy and Jolene. I don't know if they... But if they are, why, we'll greet them too. Whew! Now what am I supposed to do with all that? Throughout the history of the world, history records a lot of battles, a lot of wars, a lot of battles, a lot of victories have been won. Military victories have been won from the inside. What I mean the inside is somebody has infiltrated the enemy lines and has become friends with the enemy. And in doing so, eventually, they orchestrated things so that the enemy could be killed or subdued. They get on the inside by peaceful means, but the intent is to be is to overthrow the enemy. Here's one. This is the Greeks have a story that they like to tell. It's a legend. So a legend is something that can't be verified as fact. So I just want to let you know that it's a legend. But this legend supposedly happened around the year 1200 before Christ was born, 1200 BC. As the story goes, the king of Greece went to war against the Trojans. And I got a little map here just for a little history lesson or a little geography lesson, if I can find it myself. Where's Greece? There it is. Now my pointer doesn't work. Right there is Greece. The king of Greece. All that little thing down there is Greece. So the king of Greece decided somehow, some way, to go to war against the Trojans, which was Troas at that point, which is now modern-day Turkey, which is over here. And in the middle is the Aegean Sea. So the Greeks crossed the Aegean Sea with numerous ships, lots of ships. They gathered warriors from across Greece, and they went across into Troas at that point. And they were doing battle with the Trojans, and they come up against the city that they needed to conquer called Troy. Now, Troy was a very, as the legend goes, was a very fortified city, thick high walls. It was protected very well. They laid siege to it. They tried to batter through the walls to no avail. They finally decided that, hey, we can't go through here. We've got to come up with another strategy. So they got their commanders together and got their heads together, and they come up with a brilliant idea, if it's a true idea. They went and built a huge horse called a Trojan horse. Built a huge horse. This is a replica of it. They built it out of old planks and things. It was very tall and big, And what they did is they put 40 warriors inside that horse. They actually had two, as the legend says, two up in the head so they could get a bird's eye view of everything. So they put 40 warriors in there, and they left one guy on the outside. All the soldiers got on the ships and sailed away, and the people inside the city of Troy thought they had a victory. So they went out, and they found this guy and this horse, and the guy that was left pretended to be terrible upset with the Greeks for leaving him there. Talked bad about him, trash-talked him, and just was very angry with him. And he convinced the people of Troy that this horse, if they took it inside their city, it was safe, but if they took it inside the city, this horse would give them luck. After all, they did beat the Grecians, didn't they? So the Trojans, they drug this horse inside the city, and they had a big celebration that day. And that night, while everybody was either sleeping soundly or was in a drunken stupor, these 40 warriors came out of this horse, and they went around and killed everybody that was sleeping or in a drunken stupor. Victory was won from the inside. There's a story in the Bible, in Joshua chapter 9, kind of the same thing. If you remember, Joshua crossed the Red Sea, and his task was to annihilate everybody in the land, to conquer everybody, kill everybody, destroy everything. Well, the kings in that area heard of their conquest, and there's one kingdom come up with a brilliant idea. They said, we'll dress in old rags, we'll take old wineskin flasks, we'll take old moldy bread, and we'll go and we'll fabricate this story that we come from a long way, but we want to make peace. So they went and they talked to Joshua and the leaders, and they said, we come from a far way and we want to make peace with you so you don't kill us. And Joshua said, well, how do we know you're not from right here? And they said, well, look at our bread. This was new when we started. Now it's all moldy and crumbly. Our sandals, they're worn out. They have patches on them from traveling so far. And so the Bible records it. I don't have it wrote down, so I'm going to paraphrase it. The Bible says Joshua made a decision without consulting the Lord. And it cost them dearly. Because the Gibeonites caused problems for the Israelites all through the history. They came from the inside. Actually, one of the problems they caused was the covenant that Joshua made with them that the Israelites would never attack or kill the Gibeons, which I think it was Saul later did, and Israel paid dearly for it. More modern is the American Indian. I don't know how much you know about history, but the American Indian, when they hunted buffalo, do you know that sometimes they would take old buffalo skins and heads and dress in it, and so they could go right in with the buffalo without scaring them? One of the things that I like was this. They put on wolf skins. And why do I like it? Because the wolf was a natural enemy of the buffalo. But they could still get close enough because the buffalo, when the wolves would come, the male buffalo, the bulls, would get in a circle with their heads pointed out, and so they could defend themselves. They knew it was an enemy, but it didn't really concern them. They would just get in formation, and they would do what they had to do when the danger encroached. But they didn't chase them before they got there because they knew they could defend themselves. So they would let the wolves come close. But the problem was sometimes the wolves were Indians. Again, just a little bit of a thing of how the enemy can come close by looking somewhat friendly. Well, this morning I have entitled my message, Sleeping with the Enemy. No, I did not see the movie. No, I don't have a video clip of it. I just thought it made a good title. Sleeping with the Enemy. And the starting off text is James 4:7, which simply says, submit yourselves then to God. Submit yourselves then to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Now, resist is a military term. It means to stand against. It means to oppose. It means to put up a fight. It means to do something. 1 Peter 5, 9 says kind of the same thing. No, it doesn't. 1 Peter 5, 9 says, resist him. Resist the devil. Stand firm. Stand firm in your faith. Jude tells us we're supposed to contend or to struggle for our faith. It's a fight. It doesn't just come easy. 1 Timothy says, tells us to fight the good fight. See, all through the Bible, we find this theme that the Christian walk is not just a walk in the park, but that it's a walk on the battlefield. That's right. It's a battlefield. We Christians are at war. How many of you knew that? How many of you knew that we were at war? There, Tommy does. There's a couple. I hope many more of us know that. But I'm afraid that we don't. And if we know we're at war, do we know who we're fighting? If we're at war, we better know who we're fighting. Do we know who we're fighting? Do we know who the enemy is? When I look around at the Christian community, and I see how Christians are fighting each other, and I'll see how churches treat each other and fight among each other, I might tend to believe that the enemy is us, that we are the enemy. But the reason that we're fighting each other is simply stated in James 4:1. It says, what causes fights and quarrels among you? He's taking for granted that there is fights and quarrels among us. And when I say among us, I mean as Christians in general. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within? See, it's our own selfish desires that cause us to battle each other instead of doing battle with the real enemy. See, people, I'm afraid that when we fight among ourselves, we're showing the world that we don't even know who the enemy is. We're showing them that we don't know who the enemy is. They think it's each other. We don't know who the enemy is, let alone do battle with him. See, if we don't know who the enemy is, we don't know who to fight. Wow. If that is true, and I'm fairly well satisfied that it is that not a sobering thought? If we're fighting a battle with somebody we don't know who we're fighting, and we're fighting each other, wow. You know, when you look around and see Christian against Christian, church against church, denomination against denomination, we have to wonder, do we know who the enemy really is? You see, people, we're still in the evil day. See, we are embroiled in a war. It's not a war of our own choosing, but we're in a war nonetheless. And the enemy is the devil himself. Revelation 13:7 says, he was given power. He, who's he, the devil, was given power to make war against who? The saints. Yes, we're saints, although we don't act like it sometimes. Ephesians 6:12 says, we are not fighting against humans. See here, the Bible even recognized that this problem is going to be. But it says, we're not fighting against humans. We're not fighting a human war or a war that you can see, that you can take a gun and shoot somebody or something. No, it says we are fighting against forces and authorities and against rulers of darkness and powers of the spiritual world. See, we're fighting a spiritual war. We're fighting a spiritual war, and I'm afraid we don't know that, or we don't recognize that. 1 Peter 5:8 says, be on your guard. Stay awake. Your enemy, the devil. We're not enemies. The devil is our enemy. Be guard, stay awake. Your enemy, the devil, is like a roaring lion sneaking around to find someone to attack. See, whether you know it or not, whether you like it or not, if you're a Christian, you're called to do battle. What's surprising to me, though, is the large number of Christians who choose not to fight. There's a vast number of Christians that choose just simply not to fight. They simply roll over and go back to sleep again. And the large number of us that don't even recognize that it's necessary to fight, or that the Bible mandates that we fight, or that it's our privilege to fight, or that it's our responsibility to fight this battle. It's our spiritual responsibility. Dear people, since we're in a battle, we have to understand the way that our enemy works. First, we have to know who he is, and then we have to understand the way he works. Don't you think that would be a good place to start? First of all, we have to recognize that Satan, or the devil, is a tricky, slick, sly adversary. See, the devil doesn't fight fair. The devil doesn't come at you fairly, man to man, face to face. He's slick, and the Bible tells us that, 2 Corinthians 2:11. There it is. In order that Satan might not outwit us, for we are not unaware of his schemes. 1 John 5:19, we know that we are God and the whole world. That's not the right. Getting ahead of myself. I didn't do my PowerPoint right. Ephesians 6:11, put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. See, the devil doesn't fight fair. He's a schemer. He's sly. He's tricky. He doesn't care how he gets us, just so he gets us. The devil's a schemer. See, he knows that he's not going to get anywhere with a frontal attack. He's not going to get anywhere to attack us like the armies would, where they go out on the battlefield where you know the enemy's coming at you. No, he's not going to do that. See, he knew 50 years ago that he could not just convince Christian people that divorce and remarriage is okay. He couldn't do that. See, 50 years later, that is an accepted practice in the Christian church. How did he do it? How did he do it? Satan knew 30 years ago that he couldn't just put women in leadership. But here we are. Women in leadership accepted in every major denomination, including Mennonite. See, the devil knew 20 years ago that homosexuality would not be accepted. But now, 20 years later, homosexuality is accepted in pretty much every major denomination, including Mennonite. How does Satan get it done? See, years ago, Satan knew that he couldn't get Christians to expose themselves on our beaches. Now you're looked at strangely for taking a stand like that in our Christian churches. See, years ago, the devil knew he couldn't get Christians to dishonor the Sabbath. We talked about that in our Sunday school this morning. We're probably one short generation away from our children, grandchildren, working on the Sabbath. How does Satan do it? How did he get us where we're at? 1 John 5:19 says, we know that we are God and the whole world lieth in the evil one. See, the original language is a picture of Satan cradling, or somebody cradling something in their arms and rocking him to sleep. See, the world has been turned over to Satan, who is cradling the world and just kind of lulling us to sleep. That's what lieth in the evil one means. And while we were sleeping, Satan drug a Trojan horse inside the church. See, he drug a Trojan horse inside the church, and while we were sleeping, it was released. The enemy was released. See, he knew that he could not just bring all these sins, divorce and remarriage and women in leadership, homosexuality, you name the sin that's now accepted in the Christian circles. He knew that he couldn't just bring those in the front door in broad daylight. See, he had to package it inside a Trojan horse. He had to put on that wolf skin, because this Trojan horse we would recognize as a danger, but we let it come close enough because we thought we could defend ourselves against it. But we found out too late that we can't. Brothers and sisters, I believe without a shadow of a doubt that Trojan horse that was released in our midst is network television programming. Now, I want you to hear me well, because I'm not against having a TV set. But I believe the Trojan horse was drug in through the television set and released through network television programming. You might say, well, there's some good on it. Let me ask you something. If the water piped into your house had just one drop of sewage dripping into that thing, would you drink it? I dare say if you knew that the water coming into your house had just a drop per 1,000 gallons of raw sewage dropped into it, we would kick a fuss about it. But here we're piping filth into our homes and paying for it. Don't tell me that's not a Trojan horse that the devil is using. Again, I think the television can be used okay. There's alternatives. I don't know if there's many alternatives to network programming. And you can say, well, I just watch sports. Well, you may have to look at that too, about what's coming over that. I have some statistics. This isn't an exhaustive. I could do a whole lot more on this, but this isn't a sermon just on television. If you want, tell me, and I can do a whole one on television. This, I got off the internet, and I have some things to say about the internet, too. Wolves in sheep clothing. It's a content analysis of children's television, and it's an executive summary. By the way, if you want to know more, go on the Parent Television Commission, I think it is, PTC, and you can find all kinds of statistics and reports. It's a non-Mennonite organization. Children today are bombarded by intensely violent images in the movies they watch, the video games they play. Even the primetime TV is loaded with violent imagery. But what about programming specifically created for young children? The Parents Television Council, there it is, set out to discover exactly what young children were seeing on programming designed uniquely for them. The PTC chose to focus on entertainment programs for school-aged children ages 5 to 10 on broadcast television and expanded basic cable. 8 networks, 4 broadcast and 4 cable, offer programming matching that criteria. ABC, Fox, NBC, WB, ABC, Family, Cartoon Network, Disney Channel, and Nickelodeon. The PTC focused on its analysis on before school, after school, and Saturday morning program. The analysis covered a 3-week period from the summer of 2005 for a total of 443.5 hours of children's program. The results were staggering. Listen to this. In the 443.5 hours of the children's program analyzed by the PTC, there were 3,488 instances of violence, an average of 7.86 violent incidences per hour. Even when the innocent was in quotes, cartoony violence most of us grew up with, for example, an animal falling on Wile E. Coyote's head, is extracted, there are still, after all that violence in the old Wile E. cartoons were taken out, there were still 2,794 instances of violence for an average of 6.30 violent incidences per hour. To put this figure in perspective, consider that in 2002, the broadcast networks combined averaged only 4.7 instances. That was back in 2002, 4.71 instances of violence per hour in primetime programming. This, there is more violence aimed directly at young children than at adults on television today. So there's more violence aimed at our children through children's programs than there are in adult programming. But it is not only the violence that is present in today's program for children. Sexual innuendo is present. Adult language is present. Trash talking, bullying, and disrespect are present. In its analysis of children's television, the PTC also found 858 incidents of verbal aggression. For example, abusive yelling, mean-spirited insults, and put-downs for an average of 1.93 instances per hour. Almost two times per hour. Verbal aggression. 250 incidents of offensive language, such as excretory references or things for obscene languages, euphemisms or something like that, for an average of 0.56 instances per hour. 595 incidents of disruptive, disrespectful, or otherwise problematic attitudes and behaviors for an average of 1.34 instances per hour. 275 incidents of sexual content for an average of 0.62 instances per hour. This is for your children 5 to 10 years old. Too often we dismiss violence in children's programming as inconsequential. After all, the argument grows. I grew up with watching Roadrunner cartoons and I turned out okay. Violence in cartoons, of course, is nothing new. What has changed is that the violence is often sinister and in many cases frighteningly realistic. What makes a difference from the old Wile E cartoons is it's more realistic now. Studies have shown exposure to TV violence to be positively associated with aggressive behavior in some children, and exposure to sexual content increases the likelihood that children will act that out earlier in life. Just a couple more. In a sample of programming from 2001-2000 TV season, sexual content appeared 64%. In 64% of all TV programs, those programs with sexually related material had an average of 4.4 scenes per hour. Talk of sex is more frequent, 61%, versus overt portrayals, 32%. Research has shown that mindless television or video games may idle and impoverish the development of the prefrontal cortex, or that portion of the brain that is responsible for planning, organizing, and sequencing behavior for self-control, moral judgment, and attention. That comes from the American Academy of Pediatrics. Now, I want to be careful what I'm going to say next, because I know there is other conditions that contribute to some of this behavior of children. So I'm not casting any stones. I'm putting this out, food for thought, something to think about. I saw a piece in the paper yesterday that says the rising autism rates challenge schools. It says the number of students listed with autism as leading disorder has more than doubled. They just did a study on that's the leading disorder has doubled over last year. How many know what autism is? Okay. Why do you think that is? Or maybe we should have a good indication of why autism is rising. Doubles in 1 year's time. I think we have our answer in just some of the things I read. Research has shown that mindless television or video games may idle and impoverish the development of the prefrontal cortex of the mind. It stunts the growth. It has an effect on the way children act out. And we wonder why we come to church and our children can't sit quietly. Why they don't mind us. Why they trash talk us. Trojan horse. Something to think about. Be careful what you let in your homes. Because if you're getting a steady diet of network television, you're getting a steady diet of filth, and it's going to make a difference in your Christian walk. And worse yet, you can do to yourself what you want. But worse yet, You're going to have to answer for what, how your children turn out because of what you let in your home. The other Trojan is the internet. See, it's a great tool. I use it all the time. It's helpful, but it's also very, very, very dangerous. Again, I have statistics, so this isn't just me talking. The danger with the internet is often it's so private, because you can view things without other people knowing it. It's just you and the horse. And the big downfall of a lot of people is pornography on the internet. Here's some statistics. Time statistics. Every second, there's $3,075 being spent on pornography. Every second, 28,000 internet users are viewing pornography. Every second, 372 internet users are typing adult search terms into search engines. Every 39 minutes, a new pornographic video is being created in the United States. Adult internet pornography statistics. Men admitting to accessing pornography at work is 20%. U.S. adults who regularly visit internet pornography is 40 million. Regularly, 40 million people regularly visit pornography websites. Promise keepers men. The revered promise keepers men who viewed pornography in the last week, 53%. Christians who said pornography is a major problem in their home, 47%, almost half Christian people. Adults admitting to internet sexual addiction, 10%. And a breakdown of male-female, 72% male and 28% female. It's not just a man problem. But the difference is the sites they go to. The women that were polled are drawn to chat sites, instant messaging, because women function differently than men. Pornography, nonetheless. You may say, well, I can control it. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. Statistics show that you can't. Statistics show that you can't control it. Worse than that, you can't control what your children watch. I didn't bring those statistics, but the statistics are staggering, the amount of awful sites that children go through, because there's many, many links to pornographic sites to children's sites, from children's sites to pornographic sites. Click of a button, they'll be there if it's unmonitored and unfiltered. You might think I'm an old fuddy-duddy for pushing filters, but statistics don't lie. Hopefully you'll hear more about that, because we've been talking, Jerry and I have been talking. Wayne's left out, I wasn't here last Sunday. But of trying to do a church-wide filter to where what sites we go to get emailed to an accountability partner, because alone we can't stand. There's many other ways that the devil has come in to the church. My mind went back to Eve when the devil asked, did God really say this? And the devil's asked that for years, and I think in recent years he's changed his strategy to what's wrong with it. What's wrong with that? I've heard many Christians say, what's wrong with that? If you're asking that question, that's already the wrong question to ask. If you have to ask what's wrong with it, that proves something is wrong with it. If you can't prove what's right with it, then maybe we should let our hands off of it, or find out ways to deal with it properly. Find ways to fight the devil, not just sit there. Another statistic I read a long time ago, and I hadn't thought of it till now, it takes less energy to watch TV than it does to sleep. Talk about sleeping while the devil drags a Trojan horse into our living rooms. Ephesians 4:27 says, and do not give the devil a foothold. Don't give the devil a foothold. Not one little toehold. Because when the devil gets one little toehold, he's in. That's all he needs, because he knows if he can hang on to that toehold long enough, after a while another one's going to open up. And after a while another one's going to open up, and after a while he's got us. Don't give the devil a toehold. Don't give him a chance. Fight him. Stand against him. Resist him. See, we're at war with a crafty adversary. He's slick. He's cunning. He's smart. Let's not be ignorant of his schemes. We have to know what he's up to. Hosea 4:6 says, "My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge." See, if we don't know what the devil's up to, if we don't know what his plan is, if we don't know what his scheme is, we're going to walk right into it. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. Become knowledgeable. And you don't have to know all what the devil's up to. What you do have to know is what God is up to. We have to be aware, and we have to be prepared for warfare. Do you know why the World Trade Center bombings were so successful? Do you think those Al-Qaeda just came to this country September 10th and decided to climb on a plane? No. It took years of planning. They moved here. They lived among us. They made friends. They studied how to fly an airplane. They became friends with pilots that showed them how to fly airplanes. They studied air traffic patterns. They studied schedules of the airplanes, air routes, before they finally came to September 11. See, they became knowledgeable and they prepared. Then they carried out their mission to an unsuspecting people. Talk about sleeping with the enemy. And people, if we're going to fight that good fight, and if we're going to persevere to the end, we're going to have to make proper preparations. And Ephesians 6:10-20, we can find those preparations. And I'm just going to read it quick without a whole lot of comments, because time is getting away from me so fast. Ephesians 6:10-20 says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God." So there's something we have to do so that you can stand against the devil's schemes. "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realm. Therefore, put on the full armor of God." And he goes on to explain what the full armor is. Put it on so we can stand firm. "Stand firm then with the belt of truth buckled around your waist, the breastplate of righteousness, and with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God." Preparation. You want to know how to prepare for doing battle against God? Study those verses. Those are all a sermon all in themselves. But go home and read them and find out what it means to prepare to do battle. And after we're properly dressed, then we actually need to get in the fight and fight for what is ours. It says, resist. It's an action word. It takes effort. It takes preparation. It takes knowledge, and then it takes weapons. And then the Bible promises that he's going to flee. And that gives you a picture of a dog running away with its tail between its legs. Wouldn't you love to have that in your life? To where you actually resist the devil and he actually runs away from you? And you can actually receive and claim that promised land that God promised to us? See, in the Old Testament, Egypt was a symbol of bondage. Canaan, or the promised land, was a symbol of salvation and freedom in Christ. quick story about the Israelites. When they came out of the promised land and Moses led them, it was just several months to the Jordan River where they were going to go across and start conquering the promised land. They went there and they sent 12 spies into Egypt, or not into Egypt, into Canaan, into the promised land. And they spied out the land. You know, 10 were bad, 2 were good, and all that stuff. But the spies came back and they sat down with the people and they explained what all was over there. Two of them said, "This is the promised land. God said that he's going to fight for us. He promised us this land. Let's just go get what God promised us." But the majority of the people finally decided, you know what? If we cross that Jordan, we're going to have to actually do battle. We're going to actually have to fight. Some of us might get killed. And they finally decided that it's not worth the effort. It wasn't worth the effort to go receive the blessings that God had for them. And God turned them away and said, "You're going to wander in the desert, in the wilderness, until this generation of unbelievers has died." And that's what happened. See, I'm afraid that many Christians are like that. See, we come to Jesus for salvation. And we come to the Jordan River after salvation. We come and we see what the Bible has promised, all the good that God promises to us that believe. And we look at the obstacles that we're going to have to come over, that we'll have to battle against. And a vast majority of Christians say, "You know what? It's just not worth it. I got my salvation. That's good enough for me." But see, then after 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, God brought the new generation of Israelites back to the Jordan. And can you imagine that new generation that hadn't been there the first time, coming and looking across the Jordan, and all they ever heard was the promises that God had promised us way back then. And there it is. And they were faced with the same question. Are we going to go take what God has promised to us? Are we going to go claim the life that God promised to us all those years before? See, people, I believe that's a good picture of the church. I believe, and I don't want to be condemning or sound condemning, but I believe our forefathers, generations before us, have come to the Jordan and said, "It's not worth the fight. We're going to make these rules. We're going to do thus, thus, and thus, and we're going to follow that, and that's good enough for me, for us." And I think God has turned the Christian church back from the Jordan. And I think the church has been, well, I'm convinced that the church has been wandering in the wilderness for years because we have backed down from the spiritual battle that God has called us to do. And we have been denied entering into the abundant life that God has promised us. I believe we as a church stand at the Jordan River. God has taken us through the wilderness. God has been purifying us. God has been doing a work among us. And dear people, I believe with all my heart that spiritually speaking, we're standing at the Jordan. What are we going to do about it? Are we going to cross over? Or are we going to be like our forefathers and decide, you know what, the battle is just not worth it? We're standing at the edge of a new year. Wouldn't this be a real good time to make a commitment to renew your fight? Wouldn't this be a real good time to stand up and say, "Yes, I don't want to be ignorant of the devil's schemes, and I'm going to fight this year. I'm going to do battle. We're going to cross the Jordan. We're going to cross the Jordan together, and we're going to claim what God has for us." If you want to make that commitment, I invite you to stand right now. If you don't want to, that's fine. Now, I want you to turn to somebody and tell them what you're going to do that. Quick, it's almost lunchtime. Let's pray. God in heaven, thank you so much for your word and the truths that we can get out of it. God, would you give us a hunger and a thirst, God, to look inside your word deeper and to learn your truths, God, and apply them to our hearts. Why, God, so that we could gain knowledge and that we wouldn't be ignorant of what the devil's trying to do in our life. God, if there's anything that I said outside your will, would you strike it in our mind? But God, the truths that were said, would you brand them into our hearts and into our minds that they couldn't be forgotten? God, would you bring them back to us time and time again? Thank you for these people. God, would you put a hedge of protection around this church that Satan could not come to the inside, but that he has to be out there? That's possible, God. You said it is. And we thank you for it. God, be with us, and would you protect us this week? And God, would you bring people into our life that we could share your good news with this week? And then give us boldness to do it. Thank you. In the name of Jesus, amen. You are dismissed.